Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I am coming to you from the mean streets of Los Angeles, California today. I'm sitting over here at 317 Gimmick Street with a microphone in my hand. I'm trying to cut an open for this podcast that will do the book I just read justice. That's right. I got a book laying in front of me on the table that I just finished last night. The guy who wrote the book just walked out of my front door. You talk about a goddang hellacious book that I would recommend to anybody and everybody, particularly if you had an addiction problem, or you were obese, or you needed motivation, or just a good swift kick in the ass, or just a great story about life lessons, or learning about yourself, or discovering yourself. That's just an amazing book. I absolutely loved it. It's called Out There, A Story of Ultra Recovery, written by David Clark. David Clark was in Los Angeles working on a documentary, and he stopped by 317 Gimmick Street today, and it was good to meet him. Felt damn near like I knew him. You know, it's funny because I don't know anything about the world of long-distance running. From the research I did, it is absolutely fascinating. But one of the things I did know about, because it was so close to me, was the addiction part. No, I'm not a drug addict. I can't say that I was a raging alcoholic. I can't say that. But there's a lot of guys I knew in the business that I came from, professional wrestling, that were addicts who covered it up and guys who lost it all. David Clark was on the brink of death, laying there, and he knew the bottom line was his ass needed to get clean, and he needed to get clean for good. This short-term fixing, it ain't working. And the guy went off the deep end. I mean, he hit rock bottom. Right when you think rock bottom, you read this book. I highly recommend you read this book. You hit rock bottom. The way this guy writes this stuff, it's powerful. And I loved it. I read the foreword to the book, and I was like, okay, I got to read this damn thing. Then I read the first sentence. I said, okay, I'm in. You guys know me. My attention span ain't for squat. It's hard for me to read books. This is an unbelievable read. It's a great story. Here's a quote from a fellow ultramarathoner or ultra racer, the legendary Dean Karnazes, endurance athlete and New York Times best-selling author. He wrote, David Clark has overcome adversities most of us can't even begin to fathom. Morbidly obese, hopelessly addicted to drugs and alcohol, he not only turned his life around, but went on to complete the world's toughest foot race, the 135-mile Badwater Ultra Marathon. Inspiring and engaging, Out There, A Story of Ultra Recovery is a dramatic story about dealing with profound difficulties and having the strength and courage to persist, endure, and prevail no matter how badly the odds are stacked against you. That's what Dean Karnazes had to say, and there's a lot of other quotes by a lot of other people in the ultra racing community. I tell you what, man, there was a great podcast that was done by a guy named Rich Roll. Some of you may know of him. He has a very successful podcast of his own. It's called The Rich Roll Podcast. I listened to this podcast, and when I was listening to it, it's episode 113, Rich Roll Podcast 113. David Clark is the guest. And I listened to this podcast, and Rich Roll is a guy who went to school at Stanford University, graduated, got a college degree. He was a swimmer, and then he was an addict, and he had his demons, and he fell by the wayside and let himself get way out of shape. And then he turned into an ultramarathoner and just an unbelievably world-renowned athlete and just highly respected. And both these guys are vegetarians or vegans, as it would be. And so I listen to these guys talking shop, and I'm listening to two guys who are former addicts and two guys who are ultra racers. So they're talking about stuff that I can't even touch. So I listened to that podcast, And if you want that part or that aspect, that standpoint or that knowledge that those two guys share, I listened to that podcast. I said, man, I can't touch that. Those two guys are speaking stuff that I don't even understand. So I highly recommend the Rich Roll Podcast, episode 113 with David Clark. And I told David when he showed up, I said, dude, I said, that was a great podcast. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I said, let's just talk about the things that we're going to talk about and cover some of the broad strokes. And I asked my everyday layman's questions, probably some of the things that he's asked in the airports or everywhere he goes. But I was highly interested in his story because the world of the drugs, the alcohol, the addiction, I've seen it firsthand. And some of my best friends have went down in flames and should be here, but they are not because of drugs and alcohol. Man, sometimes I look back at the things I was doing. I know I was riding that lightning bolt pretty hard and fast. Never really got to that level of destruction. Always able to kind of maintain that Heisman stiff arm. But, you know, I was running pretty fast. But when I read David Clark's story, I was just blown away. Man, this guy, the whole time I'm talking to him, I'm thinking, man, Out There is the perfect name for this book, because that's exactly, you know, what the book is. And he says, you know, he is an extreme person. And just watching him to be able to make the recovery and listen to him speak. You got to listen to this guy talk because, well, that's what the podcast is for. But, man, I mean, you talk about doing some soul searching, and he's just a real, real deep, well thought out human being. And I had a blast talking with him. But he's paid his dues. He made a comeback. He turned into an incredible athlete. You know, here's a guy that was 6 foot, 320 pounds, and wasn't really the athletic type. And he turned himself into, you know, a world-class ultra racer. But just the stories of getting clean, looking at himself, making the adjustments, making the changes, you'll hear in the podcast. This podcast has a few cuss words in it. This podcast is in two episodes, this Tuesday and next Thursday. I knocked out the F-bombs, but there's going to be some language in this family-friendly show that is considered a cuss word, but we're talking man-to-man, eye-to-eye, face-to-face, so I'm going to let those cuss words fly. You won't hear any F-bombs, but there might be a few cuss words, so be ready for them, or don't listen to the podcast. But I didn't want to chop this thing up. And I had a good time talking to David Clark, and I wanted this thing to air in two episodes back to back. So that's why you're going to hear the first hour Tuesday, the second hour Thursday. And I didn't want to sit here and say, hey, man, let's talk like this. Because when I'm engaged with somebody and I'm talking to them, I want to be able to think freely and talk freely. And that's what I did. So I don't want to, piss anybody off. Hey, man, that's the family-friendly show. You can't say that. Today you're going to hear a little bit of that, but that's just me and David Clark talking real, and that's what we did. Once again, man, it's just an amazing book. It's an amazing story, and like I said, I don't know anything about long-distance running. I'm going to look further into it, what drives these people. We talk about some of the races in the second episode, but we talk about the destruction, the damn near death that he came to in this first part of the podcast. It's an amazing story, and one of my favorite podcasts that I've done. Man, I didn't know what to really expect from this guy. I didn't think, you know, sometimes, you know, you see a former addict, they just have this, this weird energy about them. David is very, very calming. I don't know how to describe him. And just, he's weathered storms, and he's just a very calm individual. And just well-spoken, highly intelligent, and intuitive, and just a real cool dude. I'm glad I met him. I got introduced to David and his story through Pat Miletich. Pat Miletich of the UFC Hall of Fame was on the podcast several months ago, and he told me he was training for the Leadville 100. And I told him, I said, hey, man, what's the Leadville 100? And he told me what it was. And I didn't really understand what he was talking about to begin with. The Leadville 100 is a 100-mile race, which David Clark has completed several times at the highest altitudes of Colorado. And I was thinking, man, well, why are you going to do that? And so, you know, that's how I found out about David's story when I was talking to Pat Miletich. And anyway, I wanted to bring you up to speed that you will hear some cuss words. The book is awesome. I recommend it to anybody out there. God dang it. Just what I just said. No pun intended. Anybody out there. I get emails all the time to my show email address, questions@steveaustinshow.com, asking me about training, asking me about quitting drinking, asking me about training and drinking. I get asked all kinds of questions on my emails. And this is right up my alley just because of the life that I've lived, the life that I've been in with professional wrestling, being around so many drugs, so much alcohol, the parties, the BS, the lifestyle. Man, I was there, but I didn't go out there like David Clark did. And he writes about it, and you must read the story. One more time, I highly recommend Out There, A Story of Ultra Recovery. David Clark is coming up. But first, big ups to True Car. When you're looking to buy a new car, you want to feel comfortable that you're getting a fair price. With True Car, you can get information that empowers you with the pricing context and lets you see what other people in your area paid for the car you want. It's pricing you'll see before going to a dealership so you can feel confident when you show up. And with True Car, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing. When you're ready to buy a new car, visit True Car to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
Oh, brother.
The reason it's called the NFL, not for long.
It's sports related with Jordan and Luke Rogers.
The Chargers football is not going to work in Los Angeles.
I got hit by a car on my scooter 8 days before our first game of my senior year. I was out there playing. No rib strain's going to keep me out.
JoJo, what is the last book that Jordan read?
I think he just likes to read Twitter articles.
Download new episodes of Sports Related every Friday on the Podcast One app, Apple Podcasts, or PodcastOne.com.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Man, I'm talking to David Clark. We're sitting here shooting a breeze, getting to know each other. Him and his daughter came over today, and we're sitting here about to talk about the book that he wrote about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
David Clark, welcome to my house.
Thank you, man. It's really cool to be here.
Man, it's really cool for me to be sitting across the table from you because when I first heard about you, it's through Pat Miletich.
Yeah.
And you know him pretty well, right?
I do. We're really close. Really
and
he's,
you're coaching him.
Yeah.
And we're helping
it's
him.
Kind of a symbiotic relationship. He's helping me get punched in the face, and I'm helping him run trails.
God dang. When people ask you what you do, what do you tell them?
Wow. That's a big question. You know, I define myself as a seeker. You know what I mean? Like I'm out there seeking experience, and sometimes that means I'm, you know, running trails and I own a gym. Sometimes I'm training clients and speaking or writing, but whatever it is that I'm physically doing, the reason I'm doing it is to learn something about myself I don't know and to learn something about other people.
God dang, dude. You sent me this book. The name of the book is Out There, A Story of Ultra Recovery. I told you when you came up and I was in my driveway sweeping, sweeping shit out of my driveway. Did you expect to roll up and I was going to be sweeping shit out of my driveway?
You know, I can't say I expected it, but I wasn't surprised either.
I was waiting for you to roll up. So much of my research about you and your world is foreign to me because, well, foreign and very close to home because the addiction part, I've worked with so many addicts over the period of my career in professional wrestling. I can't tell you how many I've worked with. When I had a phone conversation with you the other day, I was wondering, you know, if I was indeed at one point a mild alcoholic or an alcoholic to begin with or whatever you want to call it, or a guy that just liked to drink. So I'm familiar with some of the territory where you've been, and obviously you took it to a whole nother level, and that's why it's called Out There, the name of the book.
It is, yeah.
But when you start talking about running, I ran for football practice. I ran my miles and stuff like that, got on my treadmill, did my due diligence for wrestling. But, man, when you start talking about your first turkey trot and then your half marathons, your marathons, and all of a sudden – you discover the ultra marathons and what those guys were doing. Who was it? Was it your wife that pointed out? Was that Dane Karnazes or was it the running on the Badwater event that blew you away?
It was kind of both of them. Like the first experience was Dane Karnazes. You know, I started out at 320 pounds. You know, running was this impossible thing. You know, I mean, it may as well have been running to me seemed like a superpower. Like you may as well have been talking about flying or shooting webs out of your hands, you know? So while I was trying to find sobriety, running became this kind of affirmation of, if I can force myself to do this really simple but really hard thing every day, that if I could force myself to do that, that I might be okay on the other things too. But anyway, I went over this whole 18-month process of training and losing a bunch of weight. And finally, the big, you know, culmination of that was running a marathon. And I felt pretty damn good about that. You know, I was proud of myself, man. I was wearing my Denver Marathon hoodie around. I wouldn't take that damn thing off. You know, I still have it, actually. And I was still walking backwards down the steps because I was sore from the marathon when my wife at the time said, oh, I read this story in the newspaper. It's about this guy. He ran 50 marathons in 50 states in 50 days. Like, what the fuck is that? You know what I mean? Like, I didn't believe it. Honestly, my first reaction was just like, no, you read that wrong. You know, no one can do what I just did every day. And now the funny thing about that is like, now I think about that and I'm like, that's not even that big a deal.
Right.
You know, what was once impossible has become very routine. And that's the beauty. I'm sure we're going to talk about that, but that's the beauty of the human experience, right? We have all these barriers, these things that seem impossible, and it's just us that makes them impossible. It's not the task. So I read about Dean, and that got me on the, I need to explore this. You know, like, what is this ultra marathon stuff? And I feel like it chose me. You know what I mean? Like, when I read about these guys running bad water, 135 miles across Death Valley, and their shoes are melting, and you know, like this, they're running in 130 degrees, and I was just like, it scared the shit out of me because I had this kind of instinct that I was going to do it one day. And I wasn't there yet. I couldn't quite get there yet in my mind that I was going to do it, but I felt, I could feel it brewing. Like, I was like, one day I'm going to wake up and want to do this. And that's kind of scared me.
God dang, man. We're going to get all over the place in this. And I told David before we started, I wanted to direct you people to, like I did in the open of the show, to the interview you did with Rich Roll, because I thought you guys connected. I mean, two former addicts talking about, you know, your demons and, you know, and running. So I'm just going to jump all over the place with this. Marshall Ulrich.
Yeah.
What a legend. I come to find out in my research. Yeah. He wrote the foreword to your book. I was watching Running on the Sun last night before we were going to talk, and Marshall had his toenails removed.
He did.
Because they were presenting problems to him, you know, with respect to all the miles, all the pounding, you know, through the course of a 100-mile-plus race.
And that isn't even remotely the dumbest or craziest thing he's ever done. Like, having his toenail removed seems very pedestrian.
Man, when you grew up as a kid, I just read about your travels up and down, pretty much kind of the Eastern Seaboard.
Yeah.
And what was it exactly your father did? Because I was thinking maybe y'all were helping or building churches.
Yeah, you know, it's a really complicated story. And, you know, I had to touch it a little bit in the book. Actually, I was under the false illusion that I might be able to get through the book without touching that, because I feel like it's my dad's story to tell.
Gotcha.
In so many ways. But I had to touch it a little bit. But it's tough. He was a very smart guy. He still is, still around. Highly educated. He worked in engineering, plant management. And he just got out of it because he was, you know, working 100 hours a week. And he wasn't seeing us as kids. So he decided to start his own business. And somehow starting his own business turned into this kind of, you know, he'd read about all these founders and entrepreneurs, and he'd always find God in these stories. So it kind of sparked an unintended religious quest, too. And that took us, you know, traveling up and down from church to church. My dad started a food bank in Florida, and I kind of lived, you know, we lived in and out of his truck and in churches and in parking lots and rest stops and campgrounds. And it was, you know, now I look back at it and I see it as a really beautiful thing, because we were just surrounded by love, you know, but separated from the world. But at the time, I felt very isolated and I felt very lonely. And I think that kind of came back on me later in life.
Man, why didn't you graduate from high school?
Well, in all of this traveling, I was pulled out of school. I think the last formal grade I had was fourth or fifth grade. And my mom, you know, homeschooled me and worked with me, and I was just an avid reader. You know, what's funny is that I was disconnected from a conventional education, but instead I had Edgar Allan Poe, and I had Charles Dickens, and I had Stephen King, and I had Peter Drucker, and like all the business books that my dad was reading, and I had those available to me, so I read them, and that in a cosmic kind of thing later in life, that early reading gave me the ability to articulate my journey into my own book farther down the road, because I didn't have that conventional education. Later in life, I went and I got a GED, and I went to college, and found that formal education, but I didn't have it.
You skipped over there was the 4.0 you got on your GED. Yeah. How does that happen, dude?
You know, I'm an extreme person, you know, like my problem was more in commitment and not in application. Once I committed to something, I think that's the human experience. When we commit to something, we make that shit happen. Everyone out there is getting what's at the top of their list. They just don't necessarily know what they put at the top of their list. You know what I mean? Like when I was an addict, for example, there was no chance I wasn't going to drink or use. There was no chance. I didn't have to think about it. I didn't have to read books about it. I was going to fucking drink, and it didn't matter. And because that was at the top of my list. And so when I put education at the top of my list, because to me, you know, what happened to me when I was in my early 20s is, you know, I was trying to, I don't want to say escape my childhood, but almost like reintegrate myself into society. You know, I wanted an education. I wanted to go to college. I wanted to feel a part of my community. And so when I applied myself to it, I did. And I went about it alcoholically. You know what I mean? I jumped in and studied and read and got my GED and transferred to college and community college and regular college and got a 4.0 and took the MCATs and took the LSATs and, you know, kind of just went nuts with it, you know.
When you got caught up in the rock and roll scene, you were an aspiring musician for a while. What were you playing? Were you playing lead guitar? Were you singing, writing?
Yeah.
Pursue that? What level did it get to?
You know, in my mind, it got really big. In reality, it was like an ass pimple. You know? That was like my first attempt at trying to find myself, really, you know, because I only had myself defined, which is pretty common for teenagers, within the constructs of my family. I didn't know who I was outside of my family. And I had all this religious upbringing and stuff. And I kind of, my first act of rebellion was to go, you know, I want to be a heavy metal guitar player. You know what I mean? And I want to be a rock star. I went and I saw the movie The Doors, and I just was absolutely in love with Jim Morrison's character. You know, the tragic, drunk, you know, genius guy. You know, and I wanted to be that, and I fancied myself like that. And, you know, it broke me down. You know, it really did. Chasing that illusion really broke me down and took me to places I never thought I'd go. And, you know, I said no to drugs like 1,000 times. Until I said yes once, and that once set in a chain of events in place that, you know, took 20 years to get out of.
Well, what is it about your personality or the personality of an addict that just goes to that next level, that elite level, if I, you know, could use that?
Yeah.
Extreme.
I don't know, man. Like, I mean, I think addicts, like, our experience meters are turned up to 10. You know what I mean? Like, the lows are really low, the highs are really high. And whenever you live on an extreme, like, it's funny to me, like, my addiction and my journey towards the bottom went really low. You know, 320 pounds and you know, two bottles a day and all that. So for me to find balance, I needed to go really extreme on the other end. And so running 100 milers and running through Death Valley seems extreme to some people, but right. For me, that was that tipping point. You know what I mean? To find that balance. And then I had to eventually reel that all in and figure out how to be happy in the center, which I'm sure we'll touch on that later. But
right. But
I just think that's it, man. Addicts are just like all in or all out, you know? And like, I wanted to experience life. You know, I was the guy that would just like, you know, if four or five of my friends were standing on top of a house on the roof, and someone's like, you know, do you think you could make it if you jumped? I just jump, you know, like, yeah. I'll tell you, yep, I'm down here. Yeah, yeah, you can live through that, you know, and I think that's common for addicts. But you know what, honestly, I think that's I think that's a human condition. You know, I think that's buried within every human being to some extent, but addicts, I think, just kind of embrace it somehow.
Man, is there more than one kind of addict? Because sometimes I think that there's self-deprecating, there's self-centered or egomaniacs.
Yeah.
Is there, what is it? Is it anybody, or that just brings out whatever and whoever that person happens to be?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Because you seem to be, I mean, you're very humble, but in reading the book, you're very, very confident.
Yeah, that's an interesting kind of contradiction, isn't it? Like, I wasn't always humble, by the way, you know, and in fact, I think our greatest accomplishments in life are the things that really humble us, you know, that like when... Before I had really done anything, I felt this need to build myself up, you know. And then once I confronted myself, which was the beauty of running ultramarathons at first, I could put myself in these really difficult situations and come through and not quit and not give up and not take the easy way out. That once I became familiar with that side of me, it gave me the, you know, the humbleness or whatever. I lost the need to try to build myself up and talk about myself, because I think when people are talking themselves up like that and bragging, a lot of times it's themselves they're trying to convince. It certainly was for me. I wasn't trying to convince you that I was strong. I was trying to convince me. And in going to those places, you know, as a pro athlete, that, you know, you go to those places long enough, you know, hey, I'm strong. I'm okay. I'm going to be okay. But, you know, I think that's the beauty of the journey is perspective, you know.
Man, how were you able to function at such a high level, drinking the amounts that you were drinking? Because, I mean, this is one of the best books I've ever read. Okay. And I would recommend this to anybody, not just an addict, but to someone who's heavy or someone that can't make a decision or someone that can't commit. I mean, I just think this is that kind of read that anybody who's aspires to do anything can learn something from this book, and you can look at it.
Thank you.
It's just dog-eared to hell.
That's awesome, man. That's
all
really
the
cool
stuff. I got it. I'm too lazy to write the damn notes down, but I got it dog-eared, and I read the thing from cover to cover, and I was fascinated. But it's just an awesome read. So how were you able to function like you did for so long? Because, you know, when I look back at my days in WWF, when it was called that, man, I was, you know, bottle of night and on top. I mean, you know, town to town every single night.
Yeah.
And if I wasn't working, I was probably drinking more. And that's what I did.
Yeah.
But, man, I was on time. I was making everything happen. And I don't know if I took it to the level you did, but I mean, that's a pretty high level. But
yeah.
I mean, your stories are so vivid, and I know they're 100% true. You're, dude, again, the book is called Out There. Shit is over the edge.
You know, man, but I think like the picture you just created of what it was like for you, right? The picture of me, that is the alcoholic, right? Like the picture people have of the addict, the alcoholic is wrong.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean? It's not the Skid Row bomb. It's not the guy, you know,
beating
up his wife.
It can be, but not the definition of.
Right. But most of the people you meet, right? They're executives and they're athletes and they're teachers or they're doctors, and it's almost like they have that life at 10 meter we were talking about. So there are A types. They're driven. But there's something that they're not getting from all of that drive, from all of that success, from all of that work. They're not finding fulfillment, and it's manifesting itself as an addiction. And I've actually described addiction as a search for happiness with a poor sense of direction. You know, and that's what I think it is. Like, we're all out there searching for something, and it's just, it's not in the bottom of a bottle, but we're really, really committed to making sure it's not at the bottom of that bottle. Maybe it's at the bottom of the next bottle. You know, and for me, there wasn't enough food. There wasn't enough whiskey. There wasn't enough pain pills. There wasn't enough business. There wasn't enough money. Cause like, I had worked my way to where I should have been happy. I had everything that was missing from my childhood. I had houses and cars. I was 29 years old doing $8 million a year. I came from the street to here. Like, why am I not happy? It's like, well, because you're never going to find happiness outside of yourself. And I didn't know that. And that's why I think a lot of us don't know that. And I don't think alcoholics have the market cornered on being lost. You know, we might be the ones that are slam putting the bottle to our heads, but everyone's out there searching. You know, everyone's out there searching and thinking there's a better version of themselves and feeling like life has more to offer them, and they're not finding it.
Man, in talking to someone who used to drink a lot, and I used to like to drink a lot, you know, my flavor started off with beer, yep. And then I got into the whiskey, and that's what it was for a long time. And then I just went to vodka. There's a phase there when I went to the wines, red wines, and,
sure.
And back to the vodka, and now occasionally to the whiskey, occasionally now because I slowed all that shit down. You cover a lot of different liquids in the book, but what was your go-to MO?
Scotch. You know, I mean, that was really it because that made me feel sophisticated. You know, I mean, anything that could take this, I mean, indulging in alcohol at that kind of level where you're talking about a bottle a day and right. stuff is not pretty. You know what I mean? It's ugly. It's ugly as hell, as you know. So anything that I could do to polish that and make it look refined, I was kind of invested in.
When you were 6'0", 320, mm-hmm. and you got that red nose, you know, that look yeah. that you know, person that's really abusing hardcore gets, and you got that whiskey nose, and you're at that business meeting, and you're flying all over the place, and you're the king of sales.
Yeah.
How did you cover that up? Because, man, it's really easy for me to sit across the table for somebody and say, hey, man, the dude's tanked, or this dude's running hard.
Yeah, man. I mean, I don't know. I'm not really convinced I was covering it up. You know what I mean? Like in my mind, I thought I was. And you know, I mean, alcoholics are crafty, wily humans. And, you know, we like to throw out those comments, you know, and I was always the king of, oh, my brother's in town and I was out late every night this week, you know, and no one was buying that shit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I mean, I think if you were, you know, close to me, and I didn't let very many people close to me, but if you were close to me, you knew. Like, I mean, I remember how cathartic it felt to finally own it and start really telling my friends, hey, man, I have a problem. I had to quit and I had a problem. And they're like, well, yeah, no fucking shit, man. Yeah. And I thought they were going to be like, really? You know? But, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we think we're doing a good job of covering it. But no one knows how truly bad it is internally, but they certainly see they smell the whiskey on you. They see the bloodshot eyes. They know, you know, you're struggling. But I think people just kind of blew it off. My guess is that I was young and I was really successful and I was, you know, enjoying my success, you know, because I was, like you said, I was there. I didn't miss meetings. I was working the stores and building a business and being successful in it. And when people see those external things happening, they almost give you permission. You know what I mean? They're like, oh, he's not. You know, if I was missing the meetings and showing up drunk and having all these problems, then yeah, they probably would have rallied around and had an intervention.
Right.
But we were still selling beds, man. We were still making money.
Man, when I was reading this book, I was like, because the stories keep mounting up and mounting mm-hmm. up, and you're just watching. And as you would say in a wrestling match, I mean, you're really getting invested in this guy, this character, as it would be, this human being in the book. And I'm thinking to myself, man, because you would just come home. You'd take your clothes off, you'd get in bed, and your wife wouldn't say a word. And I'm thinking, man, this guy must have the coolest wife in the world.
No doubt.
And I know you guys are friends to this day, but she's now your ex-wife.
Yeah.
When did that start going south?
I wish I knew the answer to that, man. I mean, like, so I'm
right. Because it was years and years.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I was like, I'm almost finished with another book that I've written. And I talk a lot about the divorce in this new book. And, you know, I feel like, in many ways, my marriage was based on lies, but they weren't lies I was telling my wife. They were lies I was telling me. You know what I mean? Like, I never let her in because I wasn't letting anybody in. I didn't want to touch anything from my past. You know what I mean? And so everything that we had was built on this false, you know, sense. I would project this image. I'd take 5 or 6 memories from my childhood and reconstruct a whole life around those. And I told everyone, this is who I was. And then when I got sober, a big part of that was having to clean out all that shit and go, well, eliminate people and things and experiences. Who am I? You know, who am I really? And what is false and what is real? And that exposes gaps. And the real bottom line though is just, you know, alcoholics are selfish, you know, even when we're taking care of other people, we're selfish. And I created a big gap between us and we couldn't find ourselves because we were together for like 5 years after I got sober and we were awesome as mom and dad and we just couldn't find ourselves, you know, in the marriage. And, you know, eventually that doesn't last too long, you know, before something happens.
And you guys are friends to this day.
We are. We're really good friends and we're probably closer than we ever were.
before. And I'd heard those stories before, but I was like, that's not going to be
me.
Yeah,
how could that be possible?
That's not going to be me. Yeah.
You were talking one of the times you're trying to get cleaned up and you're fixing to go on the road and selling spas.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And airports, dude. You know the deal. That's one of the best places you can drink.
What is it about that, man?
I don't know. Flying?
People don't know you. Yeah. Like...
But no, it's just a vibe.
Yeah, it is.
You're going to go somewhere. You're going to get in a tube with wings. Might as well fire down the couple.
Let it go.
You know, I ain't got the steering wheel in my hand. Right. And if something goes wrong, I'll be ready for whatever happens. But just drinking in airports was a fun thing to do, and drinking on airplanes is fun.
You're right. You know what? There's a lot to that. Like, there's almost like this implied permission. Because everyone's there. They're going on vacation and they're having cocktails. So you're like, I'm doing the same thing I do every day, but now I'm in a place where it's acceptable, right?
You know, when you go to an airport, especially I love Vegas because the airport's open 20. I mean, the bar is open 24/7. Some of them don't open until like 8 or 10, or some of them got the blue law. I'm like, Sunday, man, are you kidding me? Don't travel on a Sunday if you're going to fly. Man, it's acceptable because you're about to get on an airplane and you're traveling, so you might as well get juiced up or at least get a buzz.
Take a couple Xanax.
Yeah,
I mean, like, I have anxiety, man.
If you go to a restaurant and just say in a city and start throwing them down, and like, dude, something wrong with this guy. He just got fired, Wall Street tanked or whatever. When you go to airport, you know, shit's on.
Yeah.
So these days, as you travel around, I mean, what are the triggers? Does anything set you off?
No,
like if I fired down a bottle of tequila right now, would you? Oh,
nah, I'd sit here and laugh at you.
I had to knuckle up, David. Love it.
I would just go, let's do this, man. I'm going to watch and I'll give everyone the play-by-play. No, man, like it's not like, you know, I felt like all of the times recovery was there for me. You know what I mean? It was there. There was like the time happened. You know, you had the Hollywood kind of rock bottom moment. You know, like I write up. There are times where like you know, two alcoholics especially get together and start talking. And you know, I read like Anthony Kiedis's book and Nikki Sixx's book and all these memoirs. And you can like romanticize, you know, the good old days, and you can like glory it up, and because it's funny, you know, and not every one of my drinking stories was terrible. Otherwise I wouldn't have done it. You know, I would have never got so far down the hole, but you can attach like all these good memories and ego to that. And in my book, I didn't want that. So I wrote out like when I was doing the outline, like, first of all, what are the stories I can remember? Cause most of them, I just don't remember. It's just empty space. What can I remember? And out of the ones I could remember, which were the ones that hurt me? Which are the ones that made me feel less of a human being? Because that's what the alcohol real journey is. It's not about slapping strippers' asses and having $1,700 bar tabs. It's about not being able to wrap your kids' Christmas presents.
Yeah.
And waking up and feeling subhuman. So I went after those stories. There's nothing glamorous about shitting yourself because you're so drunk and you pass out on a park bench.
Yeah.
And so when I first started exploring this and writing the book, I wasn't sure if I was going to release it, honestly. I felt like I needed to do this. I needed to go on the journey to write the book. But it had to be honest, because at first when I was writing it, thinking, okay, people are going to read this, I'm like, oh, shit, I can't write about driving drunk. You know, people flip out, you know. And I was like, well, wait a minute. No. I got to write the book, and then if it's too much, I won't release it. But at least what I'll have is real, you know. And that's kind of an ironic thing, because the old me would have never done that. The old me would have like said, I want to construct a really good story, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, no, I want a real story. And if it doesn't have value outside of my own journey, then that, no, I'm okay with that. So I went after all that stuff and just, you know, put it in there and let it go out there. I lost track of what we were talking about before that, but.
Oh man, I always do too. But the guy who wrote the foreword, Marshall Ulrich, who is just a world renowned ultra runner, read the manuscript a few times and helped you along the way. What kind of information? Because I want to read his book next, Running on Empty.
Yeah.
So I want to read that. But what kind of advice did he help you in as you were constructing and writing this book?
He didn't, man. Like the beautiful thing about it, like, so the way Marshall and I hooked up, he's Mr. Badwater, right?
Mm-hmm. Explain to everybody what Badwater is real quickly.
Badwater.
I mean, it's an amazing, incredible race.
It is. And man, I got an awesome Badwater story to tell you later. Don't let us forget that. It's a 135 mile race across Death Valley. And the way the race started is someone, Al Arnold, back in the early 1980s, noticed that the lowest point in the country was at the Badwater Basin. separated by the highest point in the country, and they were only about 140 miles apart. And you had to go across Death Valley to get to the top of Mount Whitney. So he, you know, being a beautifully twisted genius, you know, guy, yeah, he's like, I'm going to put on my tighty whities and my running shoes and see if I can get across this thing.
Yeah.
And he didn't. It took him many, many times, and he finally did do it. And so, and then became a race. Eventually became a race. And now it happens once a year in July. It's by invitation only. It's really hard to get into it. And it's the most beautiful, soul-sucking experience you'll ever have. I mean, it's going to strip you down to the essence of who you are and expose it to you. And it's the one race that I live in a world of crazy people, right? All my friends, a lot of them, they do ultra marathons. They've done Leadville and Western States and all these things. Badwater's the one they go, oh, hell no. You know, so even amongst crazy people, they're like, not a chance, not going to do it. So that's Badwater. And I finally got my lifelong dream in 2013 of getting invited to the race. Marshall lives in Colorado. So on a whim, I just reached out to him. And he's a gracious, you know, amazing, humble guy. And he's like, yeah, I'll meet you for lunch. And then we just became friends. And I was just finishing up the manuscript for Out There at the time. So I didn't talk to an editor. I didn't talk to anybody. I wrote the whole thing out myself. And it came up in conversation. And Marshall's like, I'd be glad to write a foreword for you or an endorsement or something. I think it started as an endorsement. He's like, but I want to read the book first. And I'm like, well, I'll let you know once it's edited and everything. He's like, no, just send it to me. And he read the whole unedited manuscript like crazy, like with all the typos and yeah, everything in it. And then he's like, I want to write the foreword for it.
Man, do you think reading all those novels you read or all the authors that you just named previous in our conversation help you with your writing style? Because, I mean, you would think that a polished and just badass writer wrote this book. That's how well constructed and told us the story is. Did that help you?
Absolutely.
It sure comes off.
Yeah, absolutely. I think completely. But I also believe that, you know, the way that human beings have gotten good at anything over the years is through a pure journey towards that thing, right? Like there was no master to begin with. We were all students. And I think whenever we approach anything from that perspective, like I think if I would have tried to write a novel,
right,
that all of the lack of formal writing education might have been exposed, you know? And I did take writing in college too, I have to say. Okay. You know, I took technical writing and stuff like that. So I did have an idea of how to construct a sentence and an outline and write it. But I think that if I would have tried to be the next, you know, Hemingway or Stephen King, that, you know, I might have fallen short. But I can write me because I've been a student of me for my whole life.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what recovery is, right? It's like what's inside, what's under the hood? Why do I do the things I do? Because that's really the essence of my book, is that I wasn't a 320-pound alcoholic drug addict by accident. It wasn't bad luck. It wasn't circumstances. It wasn't anything other than how I looked at the world. That was my problem, and I had to figure out how to change that.
But how were you looking at the world now?
You know, I think, how am I looking at it now?
Well, just in your heavy drinking days, because, you know, I was drinking, again, I'm not in your league, but I was drinking, but I wasn't looking at the world, and I'm answering the question for you get a chance to put your feedback in. I just, I was a guy I enjoyed drinking, mm-hmm. So I don't say that I was looking at the world in any certain way, but anyway, it's the podcast is about you. How were you looking at the world then?
Well, I think for me is that I had all of this stuff tied into my identity. You know, like, you remember I said, like, happiness is a search for happiness, a poor sense of direction. I think I started drinking just because, you know, it made me feel good, right? Like, it tasted good, I guess. You know, I liked beer and it gave me confidence and it was fun to do. And I think that's the way we all start. But where I switched over somewhere along the lines is I kept trying to explore that farther and farther in hopes that it would take me somewhere. You know, I think we're not like, and it's the same whether you're like, you know, eating, right? Like eating, drinking, same thing. When you eat a package of powdered donuts, you're not under any delusion that they're going to improve the quality of your life, right? In fact, you know, once you finish them, you're probably going to feel like shit. You're going to have a sugar high, you're going to have a crash, and then you're going to wish you hadn't eaten them.
Yeah.
But you're able to cultivate a temporary illusion, right? You're like, say, well, maybe it'll be enough in eating this to make me feel a little better and there'll be some carryover effect.
Right.
You know it's not true, but we indulge in it. And that's like the mechanism that's activated for the alcoholic. But the insidious part of that is that alcohol reels you in physically, and it creates not just the search, but now the dependency.
Yeah.
You know, and then once that happens, once you've mentally associated good things to this, and now your body's physically addicted to it, you're in for a fight. That's when, you know, the journey of the addict is not pretty. And whenever I read my own story, I just look at it, I think, how the f*** did I make it out? Because I remember how dark that was and how hopeless that was. And there, that morning, there was strength that wasn't there the previous morning. So
That come to Jesus moment?
That come to Jesus moment, man.
You said, I'm going to die?
Yeah, and I didn't even mind that. Like, that wasn't, at that point in my life, that wasn't a bad thought. Like, dying was, like, the least of my problems.
You
know, like, that'd be like, well, I'll finally get some sleep, you know, when I'm dead. So, yeah, I mean, like, but coming to that, like, I think people get, because I'm like, nowadays, man, I'm a Buddhist guy, you know, and people like, how do you reconcile, like, cage fighting and ultra running with Buddhism, you know, and that's another topic. But, like, sometimes, like, surrender, right? As addicts, we always talk about the surrender, right? Surrendering felt weak to me. And it's one of the reasons why I never did it. Like, I didn't want to call myself an alcoholic because I felt that sounded weak. And I'm like, there's nothing weak about me. I'm not weak. You know, I go after shit. I make shit happen. I'm not weak. I can figure this out. And that false ego, you know, prevented me from being strong. It didn't make me strong. It's like identifying your weakness and exposing it was the strongest moment of my life. And I like to say that what surrender is not like giving up. It's accepting there's going to be a fight. And that's what I did on the bathroom floor on ground zero day one was like, oh shit, I'm going to fight. And I can either turtle up and get knocked out, grounded and pounded, or I can just start bucking and kicking and try to get in this fight. And that's what finding recovery is. It's a fight.
All right, let's take a quick pause for the calls and get you up to speed on how you can save hundreds of dollars on car insurance with GEICO. All you have to do is go to GEICO.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. You can finish listening to this podcast, and immediately after, go to GEICO.com and get yourself set up. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today.
My name is Raven, professional wrestling superstar, raconteur extraordinaire, and master of the Lambada, the forbidden dance. Come join me and my sidekick, Busby, for a live podcast of The Raven Effect. Yes, sirree. The Raven Effect, my podcast with Busby. That's live on Thursday, October 5th at 9:30 as part of the LA Podcast Festival Preview Night at the Hollywood Improv. Come join us for this most momentous occasion. Tickets are just $15. That's it? I think we should charge more. Anyway, they're available at hollywood.improv.com. Hollywood.improv.com. Again, it's The Raven Effect live. Easy for you to say. At the Hollywood Improv on Thursday, October 5th at 9:30 p.m. Go to hollywood.improv.com for tickets and a free cookie. What, there's no free cookie? Oh, well, quote The Raven, nevermore.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
What's the guy's name that created the Leadville 100?
Ken Clover.
Ken Clover.
Love that
I was
guy.
Watching him on YouTube last night, and man, so much of what he was, there's a couple of videos just where that guy's talking. Holy shit. I mean, that guy's like the embodiment of tough.
Oh, man.
And reasoning, just... He goes, you're stronger than you think you are. You can do more than you think you can. I mean, he's got way more than that, but God dang that guy.
But that encapsulates it. That's it right
there. It does.
And that's what drew me to Ultra, right? Like, I quit on myself every day. Every day I'd wake up. I knew I was f***ing up, right? Like, I knew I'd wake up, I'd look in the mirror, and I'd go, come on, Dave. Like, come on, man. What are you doing? Take care of this shit, you know? And I go, all right, you're right. I'm out. I'm gonna figure this out. I'm gonna go back to the gym. I'm gonna get healthy. I'm gonna start running. I'm gonna stop drinking so much. Whatever it was, and every day I would make a pledge and I would quit every day, and like average it out. One time I was like, okay, maybe it wasn't every day. I'm just gonna give myself 200 days a year where I quit for 15 years. That's 3,000 times that I promised myself I was gonna do something, only to just throw it away.
Right.
And so I felt like I lost all my confidence somewhere in the game, right? Like, I can't do anything. I'm like, I'm like just a, I'm a kitten. You know, I've got no strength. Right. I got nothing. So this idea of like, can I become this person who can run 100 miles? Can I do the things that make even guys like my, one of my heroes, Pat Miletich, you know, self-admittedly shaking his boots, thinking about if I can do this, what would that mean? You know, can I quit on myself every day for 15 years. Can I put myself in a place where I'm going to experience pain and suffering that can end instantly by just saying, okay, I'm done. 80 miles is good enough. And can I trust myself to come through? And the answer is yes. Yeah. I didn't know that guy existed, and I would have never known unless I went out there and gave him a chance to breathe and live.
With your addictions, it was mainly alcohol, but you're throwing down pain pills. You go through some coke, some...
I didn't do cocaine, but I really liked the way it smelled.
Oh, you didn't do coke?
No, I'm just kidding.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I got you. Caught me off guard. All these smart things, these philosophical things. I'm thinking, this guy's got me going here. I missed that one. Rarely do I miss something.
Yeah, no, man. I mean, there was, it was.
Reminds
me
of a Lynyrd Skynyrd song.
That smell, right? You know, like, it was just about anything that made me not have to sit in my own skin. That's really what I was most afraid of, right? Like, I didn't know how to just sit and not talk and just breathe. You know, like, if I was sitting, I had to be thinking about the next store I was opening, the next money, how I was going to do this, what I was going to do. You know, I couldn't just be present and let life happen. Well, so
would you call that ADD? Or you just out of your skin?
Sure.
I'm not trying to put a label on it.
Yeah, I'm just... I f***ed up me disorder. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I don't know. Like, yeah, I guess, you know, I think that, I think we overanalyze that kind of stuff. You know, like, it's like I have this conversation all the time with whether addiction's a disease, right? And it's not that I don't think that's an important topic. I think it is. But it's totally irrelevant for the addict.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because you're here.
It is what it is.
You're here.
Yeah,
you're here. You're here. Yeah. Like, unless you're looking for a reason to make it easy on you, it doesn't matter. You know, you're here.
Yeah.
So you got to throw down, you know? And so that's where I was. Like, I just didn't know how to live and to sit and to breathe. So if I could eat something and that'd make me feel good for a couple of minutes, then I was going to eat lots of somethings.
Yeah.
You know? And if one pill made me feel good, then 8 pills was going to make me feel really good. And that's what I did. And I just kept, you know, trying to fill that hole, and it's unfillable. And, you know, happiness, I like to say, you know, you believe in the law of attraction? Do you?
I don't know.
Yeah. Like a law of attraction. I mean, I do. I believed in that my whole life. I think that we can draw things to us. You know, that one of my favorite quotes is, at the moment of commitment, the universe conspires to assist us. And I think we've all seen that. That person who's committed, going to make something happen, shit happens. And you can draw circumstances and people and money and anything into your life. But I don't think you can draw happiness into your life, because happiness doesn't come from the outside. It comes internally. So I'm trying to draw all these things into my life to make me happy, and it's never going to happen.
Right.
In fact, the more I draw to me, the more I'm trying to hold those things to me, because the universe is trying to take them away. Right now I'm like creating all of this suffering and stress and you know, I just can't be peaceful. I don't have a peaceful moment because I'm worried about losing what I have,
right,
while simultaneously trying to get more and more so that I'd be happy someday. I mean, that's where I was. And I had to like let go and say, well, what's real? What's really here? What's really here? Let all this stuff that I'm trying to keep, let it go and just see what's here for a while. And then I can figure out.
What are those, and you write about them, but to put into words, those first days without alcohol in your system feel like?
Oh, man. Like life. You know what I mean? Like, do you watch The Matrix?
Yeah.
Remember that line where they like find Neo and he's like, my eyes hurt. And they're like, yeah, you haven't used them. And like, you've never used your eyes. That's why they hurt. It felt like that. It felt like I'm feeling stuff. I'm feeling pissed off, or I'm feeling happy. And I don't know how to do that, because when I felt either of those things, I just drank, you know? So it was beautiful in one sense. You know, I felt like I was finally alive. And in another sense, it was learning to walk. Like, how can I be 35 years old and learning how to cope with the guy, you know, pushing his way in front of me at Starbucks and not punching him in the head? You know what I mean? Like,
but I mean, you couldn't initially sleep.
No, I couldn't. Like, I would, I think it was about 7 days in or so before I finally, I described it in the book, even like slept. I didn't pass out.
Right.
I didn't, you know, wake up one morning with no recollection of going to sleep. I actually like lied down in my bed, closed my eyes, did what we call sleep, and then woke up. And it was actually, it was almost religious. Like, it was like, oh my God, if I haven't even slept, that means I haven't done anything. You know what I mean? And like, and I actually like, when I went to my first AA meeting, I think I described it as potentially the first time in my life that I ever listened to another human being. Like, before, I would always like, okay, you talk, and then I'm going to tell you the way it really is.
Right. Yeah.
You know? And there, I was so humbled by where I was that I'm just like, you know, these guys, like, they know something I don't know. You know, like, I thought I was the smartest man alive, which is just comic. You know, like 320 pounds, I'm an alcoholic, you know, I'm losing everything, and but I'm smart. I got it all figured out. Just ask me. But, you know, you finally get broken down to the point where you let that go, and you're like, well, maybe I was talking to Rich about this yesterday, like, wouldn't it make sense that the dumbest person in the world would actually think they were the smartest person? Like, I'm probably the dumbest person. Yeah. I'm like probably the dumbest man alive. That makes sense to me, you know. And, you know, but it was coming from that place of just having your ego smashed down that allowed me to let other people share their story and let it turn on something inside me.
Could you have done what you did without AA?
Sure. Yeah, man. But I couldn't have done it without a spiritual awakening, right? Like I had to address the problem, because alcohol and drugs were the symptom for me. So AA gives you a framework, you know, to have like, to go on a journey of sorts where you kind of confront yourself and learn to be honest. You know, the big thing with alcoholics, we don't know how to be honest with ourselves, you know, because you're engaging in all this deception, self-deception. So even when you think you're being honest with someone else, it's based on a lie. And that was kind of going back to like the way it was with my marriage. Like, I thought I was being very honest with my wife. She was like the only person that I really felt I was honest with. But everything I was telling her was based on all the bullshit I was telling myself,
right?
You know? So yeah, I mean, you don't need AA, but I think if you make it about, and this is just for me, I can only speak for me, if I made it just about not drinking, I'd have just started drinking again eventually, because that wasn't the problem. You know, the problem was what I thought drinking could give me. It wasn't the alcohol.
When did you feel, man, it's like a frog's hair comparing it to your story. When I stopped smokeless tobacco, I only felt like shit for about 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
And then it was the things I associated with, you know, dipping. You know, I'd get up, first thing I put a dip in, get in my Bronco at the ranch, put a dip in. But, you know, that's nicotine. Eh, it is what it is. A lot of people have a hard time smoking. You know, it was 5 days. And so it was no big deal. For you, the alcohol, when did just the craving go away? Or the things that you like I just described, you know, you go to the airport, you have drinks. I mean, when did all that leave?
So interestingly, like I think we experience things internally the same. Like, so whether it's nicotine or heroin, the physical withdrawal is going to be different, but the internal stuff's the same, right? We experience pain the same way. And it doesn't matter if you're fighting addiction or obesity or bad childhood, or your dad whooped your ass every day, or you were bullied, or whatever it is, like whatever we're carrying around that's pain, pain is pain. You know what I mean? And it's all internal. So I don't think that like being addicted to alcohol and being what I went through gave me some sort of a specialized journey.
No, it just seemed like you were hooked so deep by the alcohol.
I was, because I was lost, you know, because I was really, really lost. But I don't want to like minimize maybe for someone who's listening out there, right? You know, that, you know, there's no rock bottom but death in life, right? Like, so if you're not happy and you're thinking about whether it's time for a change, the answer is yes. Because like there's, unless you want to go till you die, unless you want to carry your pain until you die, you may as well just get off now.
Right.
Right. You may as well change. And the way we change is by accepting that our life's really bad. And that's the answer to your question. Like, when the craving and the journey, the physical part of that, when I stopped trying to make that easy is when it stopped being hard. You know what I mean? Like, it's supposed to be fucking hard. You didn't get this overnight, you know, like, yeah. And as long as I look for an easy way out, like maybe, you know, maybe I'll go to Malibu treatment center and they'll massage my feet and feed me grapes. And like after the end of the 30 days, I'm going to be fixed, right? Like as soon as I thought it was going to be easy, you know, it prevented me from eating the pain. And it's like, you got to eat the pain. There's going to be pain. It's just worth it. And when you reach that place, that's the beauty of the surrender. When you say, I don't care anymore. I'm done. Then you're only looking for a way out. So like I get people that reach out to me all the time too. And they go, you know, Dave, like, you know, I lost my job. My wife left me, whatever it is. And these heartbreaking stories, it tears me up. And they go, what's my problem, man? Why can't I stop? And I'm like, that's easy. Your life's not bad enough yet. And they're like, what do you mean? My life sucks. I'm like, I know. Isn't that shitty? Like, how bad do you want it to get?
Yeah.
Because when you, instead of going, oh, my life's not that bad, right? That's what I always did. I was like, hey, you know, I got a business. I'm, you know, I've worked my way from the gutter to the top. You know, I'm not like you guys at AA. I'm not like that. That prevented me, right, from really getting anywhere. As soon as I looked around and went, well, yeah, maybe I've not done that. But look at all this shit behind me that I have done, right? Like when you like look at your life and go, yeah, this is bad enough, then you will find a way out. Right. That's what human beings do. We are the ultimate survival machine. We can live on top of mountains. We can live in the freezing cold. We can run across Death Valley. We can live all vegetarian, all meat, whatever it is, we survive. You can't escape that. So as soon as we leave no other option but to move forward, we find a way. We find a way, but you can't do it trying to make it easy.
Man, you brought up your weight, 60, 320. Man, you were heavy, and that was that. With respect to heavy people, yours was that. It was a bad heavy. Because it was, you know, you looked like you drank a shit. I mean, yeah, I mean, you had that red nose, red face. I drink a lot, eat a lot of shit. Look,
yeah,
you know. So I say that respect to anybody that's on the heavy side listening to the podcast.
No, I didn't carry it well, you know.
Well, I mean, it was you didn't need to weigh that much. But my point is in asking that because you have an interesting nutritional take as far as how you started doing the research to put the pieces together to figure out what it was going to take for David Clark to drop a little weight and fine-tune what you were putting inside your body because you weren't going to do the fast food anymore. You're going to eat healthy. And so, you know, in the times that I've gotten heavy and gotten light and gotten heavy and gotten light, and there's a bunch of them.
Yeah, me too.
And it always goes back to the, you know, the whiskey, the vodka, and the too much stuff and the fast food. There's really no magic answer, but I want you to give the answer or talk about your take on nutrition. And I didn't know that until I listened to the Rich Roll podcast that you were on that you switched to vegetarian or vegan.
Plant-based, yeah, vegan.
Okay, but in beginning stages,
no.
Let's go beginning stages. How did you reconfigure what you put into your body?
Yeah, so I really did like look at it. There's this amazing kind of contrast going on in my life where people used to pay me money to come in and look at their businesses. You know, they go like, "What's wrong with our business? Why is it failing?" And I could go in there and go, "Hey, man," I could point to it like this. And at the same time, I couldn't manage my own day, right? So when I was at that rock bottom moment, I was like, "Well, What is the business of David Clark look like? You know, that's a business, right?
Interesting.
What does that look like? That's a shitty business. You know, I'd rather sell that business than buy that business, right? But it gave me that kind of clinical, excuse me, perspective. And so I started looking at that, like, what do I eat? You know, why do I eat the things that I eat? And it gave me that kind of like, perspective to step away from it and look at it from the outside in, you know, not being emotionally invested in it. And that's when I realized that I was using food very similarly to the way I was using alcohol, right? I didn't think about food in terms of fuel or nutrition or anything like that. It was like, what's going to make me feel good? You know, and I use the example, like when you look at the relationship that we have with food nowadays in this country, especially, it's just so warped. You know, you turn on the TV and you see like, It's almost like a sick joke. Like we're trying to like figure out things like bacon chunk ice cream dipped in something that's deep fried and stuffed into something. I mean, it almost seems like a joke, right? And people look at it and they go, "Oh, that looks so good." I'm like, "Does it really?
Yeah.
Does it?" Or are you thinking like when you see the bacon? What is the new one we just saw on TV? A taco and the shell is a fried egg. the shell is like actually a fried egg. Like, does that really look good? Or are you thinking how you're going to feel while you eat that? Because what's going to happen, you're going to eat it and you're going to taste fat and salt and these things that our bodies are programmed to crave. Right. So eating it does feel good, but does it really sound good? You know, like, because I used to say, you know what sounds good? Nice cold beer. But what I really meant was 18 shots of whiskey. You know what I mean? Like, a cold beer didn't sound good. I wanted to get drunk, you know? And we do that same thing, right? Like this sounds good to me, but really it's like, what does that look like in its entirety? And that's what I looked at. Like, so I want to eat the piece of cake, but what do I feel like after that? How does that, because I had to do that with alcohol, right? I had to go, yeah, I want the first beer, but you don't know how to have the first beer. You know how to have one followed by another. So I started doing that with my food. I started really breaking it down, looking at it. I was a science guy in college, and I looked at, I started researching the chemical effect, the actual effect of blood sugar and chemistry and metabolism, and thinking there was other factors in play here besides just being a glutton. You know what I mean? Like, I think that in like the, you know, early turn of the century, the only way to be obese was to just stuff your face all the time. And we're not there now. You know, we have foods that affect our bodies differently, you know, so you can eat these foods that have obviously some sort of an effect on our blood chemistry that cause us to, you know, indulge in them recklessly or cause us to gain fat at a greater rate. And anyway, without making that really, really boring and really, you know, technical, the baseline for that was the glycemic index, the way food affects your body's fat storage. So I focused more on trying to heal my body in that sense. Like, I didn't want to eat things that wreaked havoc on my blood chemistry. Because, like, I'm going to give a great example for anyone that's listening. Like, if you're unfamiliar with the way food affects your body and appetite, we've all gone to like the movie theater and ordered a bucket of popcorn. And you can eat, it's like 1,000 calories in it, right? But it's all fat. And you eat this entire bucket of popcorn and you still eat. You keep eating, and then you put the bucket down at your feet and then you pick it back up and you start eating it halfway through the movie, and then you eat it and you're just constantly feeding yourself. Or you're on your couch at home and you're putting potato chips in your mouth. You eat a whole bag of potato chips. You couldn't try one time for me to grab a bucket of apples and sit at the couch or take them to the movie theater and try to eat apples for an entire 2-hour movie. Impossible, right?
Yeah.
So there's obviously something going on there, right? Like, you're full. You've eaten all of that popcorn, all of those potato chips. Your stomach's full, but your appetite is still being triggered by something. So I investigated that, and I decided that I wasn't going to eat foods that ping-ponged my appetite like that. They weren't going to, you know, throw me into glycemic, you know, blood sugar rising, blood sugar falling. So for me, that looked like lean meats and vegetables. That's all I ate. And I approached it from not trying to lose weight. I'd done that like you, man. I did that 10 times. I lost 50 pounds 10 times. You know, like, if people say, how much weight did you lose? I'm like, I think the answer is really like 1,000 pounds. You know, it's not 160. Yeah. It's like a lot more than that. But so I didn't look at it like weight loss because I'd done that and never succeeded at it. I'd always gain it back. So I just wanted to be healthy. And I looked at it towards what's going to be healthy. All of this had to be a healing for me. And I didn't need to quit drinking. I needed to learn how to be happy and peaceful. I didn't need to go on a diet. I needed to heal my body so that it was healthy. And so I totally, radically changed my diet. And the key to that was that once I gave myself enough time, I needed willpower to get over the hump, because it's hard, because you still crave those things. That's where your willpower comes in. But if you get to the other side of that, and then your body doesn't crave those things anymore. Like, I've definitely felt that somehow I was programmed to just crave Big Macs. You know, like, that was my natural state. But it's not true. We crave what we feed our bodies.
Right.
We feed it this stuff, and then we crave it because our bodies, like, get used to having it. And just like now, I crave healthier foods now. Those are the things I want when I'm hungry. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's always nice to have something sweet or something like that for dessert, but mostly I crave healthy foods.
But you kind of phrased it in the book that to me, for someone who's struggling with weight, just the way you approached, and maybe you can pick up for me, just the way you approached your new lifestyle was kind of your expectations on yourself as far as to what you put inside yourself and your expectations of what that food was doing for you. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I said I had to change the way I saw the world. That to change how I ate and everything, I had to like change the way I saw the world, and including food. And so, yeah, I changed my expectation. Like instead of looking at it like,
but I mean, you fueled yourself. You're being an athlete, yes. So fueled yourself like an athlete.
Yes, yes, I totally looked at food as healing and fuel. So instead of going, and to that point, like everything I did was based on creating a new identity for myself. We actually started on that. That's the point that I lost way back when, like an hour ago, is that identity. I had addiction and over drinking and everything tied to my identity. I thought it's who I was. I'm Big Dave. I drink hard. I party hard. That's who I am. And every time I try to change my behaviors, it conflicted with that picture of who I thought I was. So I always went back. You know what I mean? I'd like, yeah, I'd eat nothing but protein or go on an all fruit diet or whatever it is. But eventually I'd be like, you know, I can't lose weight. It's not who I am. I'm Big Dave, you know, and I drink and I need to go to the bar. And so I'd go back to that. This process, this journey was about changing who I thought I was. Like, well, maybe I'm not supposed to be Big Dave, the Irish alcoholic, red nose business guy. Maybe I'm supposed to be like an ultra marathon runner, and I just screwed it up along the way. And that sounds kind of insane, but I was willing to do insane things back then, right? Like, I'm like, my identity is malleable. I'm going to choose who I am in my new life moving forward, and I want to be an athlete. I want to be a runner. And from that premise, I worked on changing my concept of who I was. And that made my behaviors kind of fall into line accordingly. I didn't have to think about it too much. Like, I'm like, oh, you're a runner? Really? You're 320 pounds. You're a runner? I'm like, okay, what do runners do? They run. So I'd go run. What else do runners do? They eat healthy, which is actually not true, but I thought it was true back then. So I'd go and I'd eat healthy. And I started associating my new behaviors with my new identity. I put it on the top of my list of like, I want to be the guy that goes out to the restaurant and I eat the healthy food.
Right.
I'm the guy that sets the standard, right? I'm gonna be the guy that orders the salad and makes a great choice while everyone else is making a bad choice. I want that to be me. I like that picture of me.
But before, you were the guy that was 320 looking at the lean guy saying, why are you eating that?
I was making fun of him. Like, you know, that's what's so funny about the power of identity, right? Because I would have never believed, you kidding me, that I would be a vegetarian ultra runner living in Boulder, Colorado. You know, I'd have like kicked my own ass if you'd have told, you know what I mean? Like, no way, like impossible. Like, I used to make fun of vegetarians. Nothing that anyone's ever said to me that I haven't said to someone else.
Right.
That's why I don't judge it. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, I'm doing what's right for me. But it's important to know that like all of those things I thought were just solid parts of who I was, oh, bullshit. It's just all baggage.
Hey, man, I want to talk to you about when you started running.
Yeah, man.
Because I'm in the book, and I'm like, okay, dude weighs 320 pounds, and all of a sudden it says, so I started off doing high-intensity interval training. I'm thinking, this is bullshit. You don't start off doing high-intensity interval training right off the get-go. And then when I read what you were doing, I saw, you got on a treadmill, and you could run for about 8 or 10 or 15 seconds, and then you had to get off.
Yeah.
And so that was your version of, because I'm thinking, hey, man, you know, here's this badass athlete, jump on for 30 seconds, jump off, because you're just a running machine. Your high intensity was, what, 5 miles an hour, giving it every single thing you got, whatever it was.
4 miles per hour, yeah.
So, and by definition, it was high intensity interval training. But I'm thinking, how's this guy doing this? I'm thinking, okay,
is very
now
relative.
Look at the numbers. It's the truth.
Intensity is very relative, you know?
Yes.
But it was hard. It was hard for me.
But why didn't you just start walking?
I don't know, man.
You're extreme.
Because I'm extreme, yeah. Like, I needed the emotional stakes to be high, right? Like, I tried promises and low-grade change, right? And it never worked for me. Like, I think as human beings, we give our best when our best is required. And I needed to make this big. You know what I mean? I needed this to be more than just, you know, starting out walking through the park. You know, I was constricted by the laws of physics, but in the bigger picture, I was there to run a marathon. I was on that treadmill to eventually be able to run a marathon. So that meant I had to run. And if I can only do 15 seconds at 4 miles per hour and then walk for a minute, that's what I was going to do. I wasn't interested in ramping it up, you know, slowly. I mean, I did have to ramp it up slowly, but I was interested in making sure I was doing as much as I could in that moment, that I was there to work. I wasn't there to mark it off the list or to check it off and say, oh, I feel good as I worked out today. I'm like, did that get me closer to my goal? And so that's what I did. I'd run 15 seconds and I'd walk, and I'd run 15 seconds and I'd walk, and I'd commit to spending 20 minutes on the treadmill every day, every day. And that's what I did. And slowly it became, and at the same time, I'd leave the gym, you know, and I would open my big book, and I'd get on online and I'd read about guys who found sobriety, and I'd read about athletes. I read about Lance Armstrong's book, and I'd read about, you know, things that affirmed this new lifestyle choice, you know. And there is a little bit of that, you know, fake it before you make it, you know, up front. You have to be willing to be a little nuts, you know, because you're going to find the doubts. You know, I think in the book I said, you know, when I was standing on the treadmill wearing my genuine Shaquille O'Neal sized uniform pants, you know, I'm 320 pounds. I'm wearing these huge, gigantic basketball shorts and a cotton sweatshirt. And I'm like, I don't care. Let them laugh because, you know, I'm committed to this. You know, I'm committed to this no matter what. So, you know, that's it. A little bit every day in recovery and a little bit every day in running, you know, started picking up some traction, and the numbers started coming off the scale, and I started to feel better about life and sobriety. In 15 seconds became 20 minutes on the treadmill, and one day became 1 week of sobriety and a month of sobriety and 90 days of sobriety. And to me, that's the beautiful relationship between like running and recovery, is that this small little work every day turns into something big. But you have to be willing to be present in the process, right? Like I even stopped weighing myself along the way because right. I wanted to control that number, you know, and it's like, I can't control that number, you know, like that's the ultimate, the alcohol wants to control everything, right? And there is no control. You can change it. I can change the number, but I can't control it. So like all I did was worried about what I was doing each day. Am I eating right? Am I working out right? Is my body changing? Can I feel it changing? Is it changing in the mirror? And if that's happening, here's what the number is. If the number still says 320 and I can go run a marathon and I like the way I look, I don't care.
Right.
Right.
How important was it for you to log everything down? Because I was amazed that you had the wherewithal, you know, with where you're at and just getting started on your journey to log all the information that you did. And with respect to consistency and being able to look back at what you had done.
I have logged every workout from the very first time I stepped on the treadmill to today's workout that I did before I came over here. And I don't know why I did that, but I'm really thankful for it, you know? And I look back at it, and I even have a day planner from 2005, where at first I was logging it just like I would write on the day. I'd write like my weight, you know, when I first started out, and I would write like, you know, 20 minutes, this, and I'd write like 2 chicken breasts, 3, you know, salad, like just writing what I was eating. And then within a couple weeks, it became much more formal than that, and I started logging on a website. And that's where I've logged everything else since. And I can go back, and I'm so glad I did, because when I'm talking to someone who's trying to make big change in their life and they're starting back where I was, I wouldn't have remembered it accurately if I hadn't done that. You know what I mean? I would have said, well, certainly I was running 3 or 4 miles back then, right? You know, because we do that. And I know I wasn't. And I'm glad I looked at it. I could look back at now and go, you know what? I didn't lose the weight because I became an ultra marathon runner. You know, I couldn't do any of that shit. Right. I was doing 20 minutes a day. Like, that shit came way, way later. Like, yeah.
Yeah, because I just sometimes you ain't going to undo 320 pounds in 2 months, 3 months. I mean, it might take, well, it didn't take you that long. A couple years.
Yeah, 18 months or so.
Yeah, 18 months. I mean, which is a long time, but it's the process. And you always say in the book, trust the process.
Well, yeah, because I could have taken that weight off sooner. You know, I'd lost 50 pounds in a month.
Right.
You know, going on some strict, crazy, unhealthy diet.
But sustainable. Last.
Yeah. And that's what I was very cognizant of, the fact that whenever I reached my goal weight, that there had to be a clear path moving forward. You know, like, am I going to like be on the Atkins diet for the rest of my life? No, that's why it doesn't work. Right. So what I was doing had to both bring about change and be sustainable.
What was your workout this morning?
Oh, this morning is just 7 miles on the treadmill. Which is a, I shouldn't say that like it's nothing, but it's a very little workout for me. It's just, I'm getting back to healthy, actually. So I've been running 80 or 100 miles a week which is my typical thing. But then I'm putting in a recovery week, and that's where I am now. But I've had an interesting year. I've been pretty bulletproof for 8 years. I've run 30 some odd 100-mile foot races, and I've run across the country with some friends, and been pretty bulletproof. But this year, I battled through a couple injuries, and it took me a while. Patience was an amazing process, something I'm writing about and even doing a documentary about, but of finding peace whether I can run or not. And it was really cool to see that I could kind of let that go and let my body heal and still be good spiritually and mentally.
So are you saying then if you couldn't run that you were worried about what might happen on the backside?
There was a time there that was absolutely true.
But now, no worries.
No, I mean, I enjoy running. So just it would be if I couldn't do it, it would be okay and I would be happy. But I'm not going to just surrender it, you know what I mean, when I don't need to. So I like to think that, you know, running is just a vehicle for self-discovery. That's all it means to me now. You know, I'm done, you know, proving anything. You know what I mean? I don't have anything to prove to myself. But I do want to continue to explore who I am and what I'm capable of.
But was Badwater and Leadville part of the proving process?
Yeah.
All those kind of races?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's really the point of the documentary is that I had last year, I'd done all these amazing things, and I celebrated, well, I have 12 years of sobriety now, but in 2 years ago, I had 10 years of sobriety, and I went on this quest to do 10 epic things for that year, each one representing 1 year of my sober journey. And I called it the Zen Epic 10, and I wanted to do it to be present and aware in those races, like to make it like a monkish meditative experience. I want to take everything that's happening during these events and try to be as present as I've ever been. And I did that, and it was an amazing journey. And I did things like I ran the Boston Marathon 4 times in 1 day. I ran 48 hours on a treadmill. And I had an amazing year out of it. And after that, instead of like kind of taking some time off and letting that sink in, I just kind of doubled down and started jumping back into other things. And for the first time in my journey, I started to feel a little like that out of control guy. You know, like, what are you doing here? What does this look like? You know, and it culminated in on my 4,000th day of recovery, the Leadville 100 that I write about in the book. I went back there and said, you know what? I'm going to run this son of a bitch twice. I'm going to do 200 miles. And I went out there to do it, and I invited a friend who's a filmmaker. I like, let's film this thing. Let's see what happens. Let's push the boundaries of the human body. And what happened is I had a total kind of like another spiritual awakening. I was like out there going, this feels like Addict Dave. You know, this doesn't feel like Seeker Dave. This feels like Addict Dave, you know. And so I had this like reckoning out there, and I even broke down and I was crying. And of course, Bobby, my friend being a good filmmaker, shoved a camera in my face, which must have been hard for him to do. But I'm glad he did because it captured the rawness of it. And it sent me on this journey to kind of explore what is going too far look like. You know what I mean? Like, can you go too far in a good way? You know, or is it by definition bad to be extreme? And I don't think it is, but I wanted to explore that question and open it up to other people.
So where are you at right now with that thought or that process?
So I believe that, you know, we've talked about it and joked about it. You know, I'm an extreme person, right? And I like extreme. You know, extreme's okay. And like extreme is what pushes the envelope, right? I don't think there's anything too great for a human being to try to accomplish. And it takes an insane amount of determination to do that. However, if we have to be choosing it, you know what I mean? We can't be in the passenger seat for it. It can't be choosing us. I think when we lose ourselves in that process, that's when the danger sets in, right? The ultimate question is for me, I can only speak for myself. Is what I'm doing making me happy? Is what I'm doing bringing balance and peace to my life? Is it make me a better father? Does it make me a better human being, a neighbor? Is it inspiring other people? You know what I mean? Is it a positive force? And if the answer is yes, do it, man, whatever it is. Jump out of the plane, run across the country, you know, be the best piano player in the world. But if you're losing yourself in it and all of the things you love are being pushed away from you, then that's not where I want to be.
All right, everybody, give me the go-home cue. It's time to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. But before I do, I want to thank my guest today, David Clark, the author of Out There, A Story of Ultra Recovery, for coming by 317 Gimmick Street. Man, it was awesome meeting you and great talking to you. And congratulations on all your hard work and your success. Part two of the podcast with David Clark will air this coming Thursday. We wrap things up and talk about some of the long-distance races that he's ran. Just a fascinating story. Just a guy with a lot of damn guts to come back what he came back from. And I tell you what, if you guys want something to watch, I enjoyed the documentary. I guess I saw it on Vimeo, but it was called Running on the Sun. And it was a story of the 1999 Badwater 135 and what these athletes are putting themselves through, the stuff that they do to keep going out there. And it's just a real interesting watch. I enjoyed it. It's not the greatest documentary in the world as far as, you know, setting production records or covering all the information, but nonetheless, just a step in that world to get a little bit of an inside glimpse is pretty fascinating. I enjoyed it a lot. It's not going to knock your socks off, but it will open your eyes, definitely, for sure, and give you at least a dose of what that's like. I want to talk back to Pat Miletic one of these days and see how his training is going to go for the Leadville 100 and when he's planning on running that damn thing. That's going to be interesting. Matter of fact, I'm going to call him when I get through with this close. Hey, man, the season premiere of Broken Skull Challenge is tonight, 10, 9 Central on CMT. All the shirts that I'm going to be wearing, you can find at ProWrestlingTees.com. Got a bunch of badass new designs. Check them out. If you're thirsty and you want a beer after watching Running on the Sun, find my beer, Steve Austin's Broken Skull IPA at El Segundo Brewing Company. You can find it in California at Whole Foods and Total Wines. If you ain't in Cali, check out InsideTheCellar.com and see if they ship to your state. And if you're looking to get either the Cold Steel Broken Skull Knife or the New Working Man, you can find them at my new Amazon store. Amazon has the best price on both knives. Just go to amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin. I want to say one more thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. You can find all my sponsors at podcastone.com. Just click on the Killer Deals button at the top of the page and then click on the Steve Austin Show banner. And speaking of Podcast One, the new Podcast One app is now available for download at the App Store or Google Play. There ain't another podcast app like this one anywhere, and that's because the new Podcast One app is loaded with some cool features that lets you do a lot more than just listen to your favorite shows. You can access behind-the-scenes photos, articles, and connect with other fans of the shows you like. And you can watch over 1,000 360 virtual reality videos. You can actually watch some of your favorite shows in virtual reality. It's like you're sitting right in a room with them. So get to the App Store or Google Play and download the new Podcast One app now. Folks, if you want to follow me on social media, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Austin BSR. Until next time, folks, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.